Thanks for tuning into this episode of PageCast, proudly brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Today's episode features Gaslight by Femi Kayode. In this follow-up to Kayode's action-packed and spirited debut, Philip Taiwo returns to solve a missing persons case, and in doing so, uncovers dark secrets the church has worked tirelessly to hide. From the very first chapter, Femi's Gaslight immerses you in the world brimming with drama, psychological twists, and intrigue. Kayode's storytelling is both thrilling and imaginative, leaving readers eagerly anticipating each turn. The novel explores the paradox of a Forbes-celebrated pastor bishop who operates in the nexus of old and new wealth, yet faces severe public scrutiny. As tensions rise and suspicions grow, the question remains, in a world where so many feel uneasy, who and what is truly to blame? In this episode, Femi engages in a lovely conversation with Dr. Wamui Mbao, writer, essayist, and English lecturer at Stellenbosch University. Enjoy.
Good afternoon and welcome. Thanks, Femi, for joining me today. Kind of start with a zoomed out question before zeroing in again. So, Femi, this is your second novel. And I'm interested, you know, if you would kind of start by telling us about the journey from, you know, Light Seekers to Gaslight, which obviously is what we're going to be talking about today. Technically, on paper, there doesn't seem like a lot of distance between those novels in terms of time. But of course, you know, a novel takes a long time to kind of come to fruition. And, you know, that process is an ongoing thing. So would you talk us through the journey from your first novel to the second?
Yeah, I think I'm one of the lucky ones. I got a two-book deal. The journey to the second one was already like mapped out from day one because I had to pitch the second story, not just to my publisher, but also to my agent because they wanted to be sure I wasn't a one-trick pony. I did pitch the story along with editing Light Seekers. While I was editing Light Seekers, I pitched the story kind of thing. And so I got a two-book deal and that's really helped in terms of also while editing Light Seekers, having a sense of the kind of setups that you know that you're going to sort of like have to deal with in the second book kind of thing. I mean, Light Seekers was my sort of part of my MA program, my MFA. Gaslight was part of my PhD studies at Bath Spa University. So from an academic point of view, I just sort of like carried my thesis through that whole process and all that. I don't know, maybe that answers your question, at least from a practical point of view, how do you flow from this place to this place? Because again, I'm writing a series. So for 10, 20 stories, sort of like in my head, the problem is that the story I'm supposed to be writing now is not the one I'm thinking about.
Your mind is on sort of book six when you're actually supposed to kind of be.
Exactly, you know. So I'm like, oh, I'm working on Gaslight, and I'm like, oh wow, yeah. But wouldn't it be cool if he suddenly, you know, went to Ukraine to try and find out something, you know, like that. I mean, that's 20 episodes down the line, you know, most likely when you're 80.
No, thank you. I mean, that's a great way to open up. And I think that brings me very roundly to my follow-up question, which of course is that thing of coming back to a character. You know, you start off with the character, in this case, Dr. Philip Taiwo. I'm interested in what your sense is in kind of returning to this character, you know, like coming back to him for the second book must have been quite interesting because obviously in as much as you've established him in the first book, there are going to be things that kind of evolve and change with the story from one book to the next. So what was that process like for you?
I think it's a bit like coming back into the Big Brother house. You know, the all-star thing, you know, you assume that because everybody knew each other from whatever season, whatever, and then they come in and it's just like high five, and it just goes on. There are things that distance has made you realize. It's like, maybe the Big Brother house is too much of a far-fetched example because I wouldn't be caught dead in a Big Brother house. But I really think that it's like meeting an old friend that you went through some really tough times together He has seen your butt bed. He has wiped your snot. And you go away for a bit. And then he says that he's traveling through town and he would like to see whether we can have coffee. And then you're suddenly nervous because you're suddenly, this person has seen you at your most vulnerable. So the initial 10, 15 minutes, which in real time, it will be the first 3 months of writing, tends to be almost like a dance, you know, of record sheet kind of thing. And you just sort of like test whether you know each other. Will you remind me of my failures? Will you remind me, you know, that I was once like this and like this? You know, will he be arrogant? Or will I even approach it as if, you know, I know you, I created you, and so you should bow to my whim because after all, I published you once, kind of thing. So it's a very complex thing because, to be honest, I did approach it with a sense of like, oh, no, I know him. You know, I really know him and all of that. But when you now start actually just, you type chapter one, you know, and you say, I, and then suddenly you're like, are you sure? Are you sure it's I? You know, who are you talking about now? Are you talking about family or are you talking about your version of Philip Taiwo, you know, who you've not, you know, engaged with in over a year, you know? So it's very interesting. And I like the question that you're asking a lot. That's why I think I'm taking so much time answering it because I've never really traveled through the journey of reconnecting. And now I'm working on book three and I find out that it's exactly the same feeling. This testing of the water. I remember that thing irritates him. So, you know, he should be irritated. And then there's some quirks that he forgets and some quirks that you remember. And you're like, I still know him. We're still connected and all that. Yeah. So that helps. I think it's actually very, very... it's a complex relationship, but it's more the supporting characters for me that I find a bit difficult to get into in a series. Because I'm sort of pretty clear from a plot point of view, the role of my main character. Yeah. But then in a series that people have started having beloved characters, you know, they've started having their favorites, they've started having certain things. You know, it almost feels contrived to try and pass them into the story. You understand? So you have to spend a significant amount of time thinking about how to bring them into the story in an organic, authentic manner that does not come across as if you've done a focus group and you said, look, if you don't bring Chika back in book two,
people will be very upset.
You know what I mean? Yeah, so that's how I see it, to be honest, you know. And so it's exciting, it's scary. But it's definitely a journey in self-discovery and growth. Because somehow, where you met them 5 years ago is not where you are meeting them 2 years later. In real time, 2 years have gone between, or 2-3 years have gone between the writing of the first book and the second book. And that's just saying something to the young writer out there who's going to get his debut out, spent 5 years writing his debut. He gets a 2-book deal. He gets his debut out. You are going to get only a year to write the second book. Just saying. You know, so it's really difficult, right? You know, you write that first book like 4 years ago. You're looking for a publishing deal. You get a 2-book deal. And they now tell you that they want the second one. And 5 years have passed between them. So for me, that's very difficult. Yeah.
It's quite a process. It is quite a process. And I think what I liked about your answer is that you definitely touch on something that I think is quite specific to this genre, which is that, you know, when you're writing a character like Philip Taiwo, because he is a sort of detective figure, and again, we'll touch on that in a bit more detail now, he is, in one sense, he's a character that's easy to pin down, but the world of, you know, this novel is also made up exactly by all of the other people that he interacts with. And this is definitely, that's what makes the world believable. You know, it's kind of not just the main character, but then the entire kind of landscape. And I think that's one of the things which always determines whether, when you're writing, you know, something which is in this genre of sort of, you know, the detective novel, the thriller, the suspense tale, that's what determines whether it succeeds or fails, how well you're able to kind of realize that world, you know, how believable you mm-hmm. can make that. And I think mm-hmm. you've done very, very well with this novel. You know, when you read it, it comes to life, it lifts off the page, you know.
But I think just to point that, I think that has a lot to do with the fact that there's very little to imagine. I think what I put in the work, where I put in the work, is the dynamics of the relationships. But in terms of world building, it's hardly J.K. Rowling, hardly, you know, Tolkien, you know, hardly, to be honest, hardly even quite some writers that I really, really admire in their ability to create world views.
I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit. I think that, you know, it's very easy to make a very one-dimensional world, and you succeed in making this the world that the characters navigate, the spaces that they move through, feel, you know, you capture that texture.
Tangible.
Well.
Okay. Thank you. Let me take it like a compliment, as the compliment that it is. But I think mechanically, again, what I wanted to just, you know, put forward is that there was a lot of work that was put in the dynamics of the relationship, which is something that, to me, maybe I underestimated from a creative point of view. I just felt, you know, we needed to, you know, he has children, and what ages are the children? And from a demographic point of view, you know, what if, you know, is this accessible to a teenager? Would the teenager see themselves in the story? What ages are they? And how many books can I put in, or can they appear in, before they go to university? You know, these were very, very practical questions that I actually listed out, you know. How old is he? How far is his wife? Can his wife still have another baby? You know, is it possible? They made a conscious choice not to have a baby, have a fourth child, but is she of and the age where she can have another baby? And how is it possible? And how far into the book? So those dynamics are so important in terms of maybe the world, what we call the world building. But for me, I just thought it was important in terms of the interrelationship. Yes, the architecture, and your ability to use them to create conflict or to drive conflict or to drive the plot. So yeah, that I spent a lot of time on, you know, but I didn't consider it creative because I thought it just had to be done. You know what I mean? Sure. But I take the compliment. Thank you. Yeah.
So as you can see, our dear writer here is a very, very humble soul in terms of his own achievements.
I'm going to say not quite humble. I will tell you specifically, Bamui, that the parts that I think that I put in a lot of work, I'm going to go, I did it. Give me credit to you. But the parts that I did unconsciously, to be quite honest, I just took it as, you know, as per course, it needs to be done. So a man's going to do what a man's going to do, move on kind of thing. So that's why but if you tell me that, you know, he's a genius, thank you, I'll take it.
It is. It comes together very well. I think, you know, we've kind of gotten ahead of ourselves a little bit. I realized in retrospect.
Really?
Yeah, maybe just let's slow down a bit. And maybe for those who haven't read the novel, would you give us like a brief summary of what actually happens without any spoilers, you know? And I think, tell us what's going on in this book.
Oh, that's, I've had this dance before, eh? Never gets easy. You know, how do you tell the story? You spent a year and a half writing.
Yeah, it's a horrible question to ask someone.
Yeah, you know, and then
the
don't give any spoiler.
Yeah.
Yeah, the elevator pitch. But it even gets worse. You know, I was reading something yesterday and said, and I spend all this time writing this book and trying to get the right words so I can communicate it perfectly to the reader. Mm. And yet I'm taken from one festival to the other and asked to explain the same book. So Gaslight is based on a crime that might or might not have occurred in a megachurch. The wife of the pastor of a megachurch in Nigeria has been accused of murdering his wife. There's nobody. There seems to have been some kind of scuffle in his house. But, you know, the wife is known to travel a lot for retreats. And so basically the disappearance, but now they're arresting the bishop. And Philip Taiwo has been called by his sister who goes to that church to come and have fled the bishop's name. And in the process, Philip uncovers a lot of things that might or might not be related to the disappearance of the first lady. And then things take a very dark turn when bodies start to fall.
Thank you.
Does that help?
That's a very good proceed. You stopped at exactly the right point. I mean, Gaslight is in one sense, you know, as we said, it's a detective novel. And here, I think what's useful to clarify is that, you know, Philip Taiwo is at pains, you know, throughout the novel to clarify and to point out to people that he's not actually a detective. So in some sense, I think, you know, when you read the book, you get this feeling that you as the author, you know, from your authorial position, have a vested interest in this genre, you know, the detective story, the mystery story, and what it can do. I'd be interested to know what your interest is with stories like this, with this particular genre, you know, because it's a very distinct kind of framing for this novel.
Crime stories have a unique place in contemporary literary world, mm-hmm. because it is the one genre that affects every strata of society. Mm-hmm. It is the most democratized literary genre.
Yes.
Some people would call it pop. I don't know what that means, you know, but I do know that the fact that it's accessible has a lot to do with the fact that crime affects us all.
Affects every one of us, exactly.
You know, every one of us all, you know, young, old, crime affects us all. And it has something subliminal about our ability to see injustice corrected, wrongs righted, to sometimes even uncover how it's done, how a crime is committed. Can sometimes be as exhilarating and informative as solving that crime, and I'm not talking about the overdone serial killer thing. I'm just talking about just somebody, a writer, just really taking the time to unpeel the layers of the process of a crime. I like the genre a lot for that. The last thing I think another thing that I really like about the genre is that, especially when you're talking about the detective, the detective, whether amateur, whether trained, whether he's actually even a policeman, if that makes sense, at least in our culture, but that's a righteous detective who wants to, you know, get to the root of an issue. I think that appeals to our primal instinct of having a hero that looks like us without a cape, but also the fact that the detective is also someone that can go from different people and be the mirror into the society. You know, it's really what excites me about that genre, because it's a singular voice and a singular, but with multiple perspectives, and they're all focused on one crime, not multiple crimes, just one thing, and so many things go into it. So the genre really, really excites me because of that. And there's still more I could say about it, but we don't have the time. But for me, that's why I enjoy that genre. It's not limited. It's multi-focused. Even for me, for instance, I'm writing in the first person. But the amount of research that I have to do and the amount of processing that this character has to do is mind-boggling to even think that some people write multiple points of views in the third person.
Yeah, it's a lot of webs to draw together. And I think some novels to get a bit tangled in their own website. Lucky, that's not a problem that you
have. It does happen.
I think your plotting is very well-structured in Gaslight. I think you bring me on to my next point, which is also that, detective novels, suspense novels, crime stories like this are, I think, when they succeed, when they work well, it's usually because they're about more than just, the actual crime, which is at the center of the story. They're also about, human nature, the puzzle of why people behave the way that they do, why people, act in certain ways, human nature and things of that, not at that level. And I think, of course, with Philip Tibor, you have someone who is this very keen observer of society, and you place him in this context where he's looking at, the phenomenon of the megachurch and all of the personalities that cluster around that and going like, okay, how do all of these people come together around this mystery? What is their involvement with this? And that is what makes the story so complex, because it's also a very social story.
It is. It was very difficult to trim it down. It was very difficult to not get bogged down by the almost like what you can say, the noise, because everybody will have a point of view and things like that, but there are just so many points of views you can put on paper, So I approached it almost again clinically. For instance, the deacons, the elders, for instance, I was determined that there would be 12 disciples, so obviously it's very symbolic, but it just helps you. Yes, it helps you to be able to be grounded in the reason why you made those choices, or else you were just going to veer off, the holy grail that you've created for yourself, that kind of thing. So by justifying my decision with, say, for instance, the Bible in this case, or a historical fact in this case, it helps me to stay the course. It's a social drama. There's lots of things about it. But I also think, again, going back to what Philip Tibor does, it allows me by looking at it through Philip Tibor's eyes, it allows me to take a complex situation and walk it through his mind to simplify it.
Yeah.
You understand? But because if I had many points of views expressing themselves in this type of book, I think I would really be overwhelmed by the amount of information that I have to give. However, but because he's taking in all of this information and then he's synthesizing it, it becomes a bit more organic. And because he's an orderly person, a complex situation suddenly takes on this. As long as you follow the way his mind works, you're going to get it.
Methodological process,
Yes. So the idea was really just to make the reader trust him. As soon as you can make the reader trust him, they'll walk with him in any direction simply because they trust that he has the ability to simplify complex things, and he wouldn't necessarily speak, or come to a conclusion or sort of like figure and how to explain it.
What I like about him is also that, even though he's a very methodical mind, he's also someone who's capable of admitting when he's taken a wrong step somewhere, and he's constantly kind of checking even his own assumptions, especially in relation to, the church. He has his own feelings and prejudices, and he tries to make sure that they don't, they don't over-inform the decisions he comes to or how he reads certain characters. And again, that adds a layer of complexity to things, because here you have our main character actually kind of demonstrating, that he's not perfect. He's not capable of just reading the world in this completely perfect way. But he has that level of self-awareness, which makes it very interesting.
Yes. I think it's also deliberate. I think sometimes in my life, my own personal life, when I'm working on a Philip Tibor book, there's always something that is happening, and I am learning to sort of channel the energy. And even while I was writing Gaslight, I had some questions for God. Let's just put it that way. I had some questions for God, and I felt, so those parts of his doubt they are some of the more real parts, of my own experience and my own journey while writing it. It's not fictionalized at all, in terms of, of course, yeah, filtered and curated to put on the pages of a book. But fundamentally, it had a lot to do with, how does somebody as jaded as he is, find himself in this space. But I also think it worked on a dramatic level because he did not go into this assignment to find faith. So I think it helped. It was an instinctive choice, but it did help to enrich his objectivity.
Oh, I like his, at times it always verges on religious skepticism, but I like that element that he brings to things because, of course, the entire kind of evangelical megachurch structure is such a provocative, kind of space to think through and to engage with. The way he kind of focuses on each of the individual characters who make up that world makes for a very kind of compelling story. So I'm interested in why you chose that setting, of the kind of the megachurch, because of course on one level, there's a very distinctly powerful kind of local flavor to that. Megachurches are a big deal in many parts of Africa, Nigeria, South Africa, and so on. But that kind of evangelical church spirit is something which is, found in all parts of the world in different flavors and forms. And that makes the story very relatable, in a kind of global sense. The fact that you're kind of dealing with something which is a very distinctly kind of worldwide phenomenon.
I think for me, I told it unlike, it's a cautionary tale. The church, I chose the evangelical church, or I chose the church as a symbol of blind faith. Blind faith, or what I call the culture of idolatry that exists in the world right now. This idea of that one person suddenly has the universal answer, the key to it all. Motivational speakers, Oprah, Kim Kardashian, they have people. I think it almost started, at least in my consciousness. Do you remember those days when Michael Jackson, they would show footage of Michael Jackson, and then people would be fainting?
Yeah, people fainting in the aisles and having to be carried away.
Carried out and all of those kind of things. I was always fascinated by those things because it's so easy to vilify the church nowadays, the evangelical church, because we see exactly the same thing happening, but we never relate it to the Michael Jackson experience or the Beyonce experience or the, now Taylor, the Swiftie experience.
How this people can be captured by charismatic figures.
Exactly. And they are uplifted. They are sort of like, uplifted beyond, those are the nice ones. Let's talk about Donald Trump, if anything close to, let's just think about it. It took how many women to come out before Bill Cosby could be convicted?
Yes.
Cancelled immediately. Cancelled. Cancelled, The places where he gave endowed chairs to universities, they returned the money. We don't want to have anything to do with you. This man, we have it on audio. Now, these are women that came against Cosby, right? They came and we believed them. I'm not saying, but these people came and they made all these accusations against Donald Trump. And the people that trust him or his followers or his constituents never said, we don't believe him. They said, we believe him, but that's how we want him. Joseph, like, that's how we want him, you know? And that I actually find a bit more fascinating, this idea that despite the flaws, you know, they're almost like packaged, like believing in a brand, you know, kind of thing, you know? If you go to half the people in the world now, you ask them, does Oprah have a man in her life? Many people won't know who Stedman is. Do you know what I mean? But so it's a brand, a package. People don't necessarily believe beyond the veneer that is presented to them. But in the case of Trump, there's depth to the knowledge. There's depth, you know, it's on TV, you know. So
there's so much evidence, you know. Yeah.
There's so much evidence based, you know, that should horrify you when you're talking about, if half the things that you're hearing about from Trump, the whole community will turn him. If your neighbor did half the things that Trump has been accused of, evidence based accusation, the whole community, everybody on your street or in your body corporate, if you come together and say, let's kick him out. You know what I'm saying? Your neighbor, you know? So this idea of why did I use megachurch? I just used megachurch because this seems to be a much more, oh God, please forgive me for saying this, irrational space that I can link to the, maybe that's why it's even called in some of these churches, it's called the charismatic movement.
Yeah.
And so I've always been fascinated with that. And I think now I thought about it, Maumui, I now feel as if I'm in therapy, because when I was growing up, I think I must have been 11 or 12 when I watched this movie on TV, on our black and white TV, called The Guyana Tragedy, the Something Jones story. And I think I was even younger, because all I can remember was that this man was saying, I think the film was made in 1979 or something. It's this man saying, no, you meet God, you do what? And they are passing poison around. And,
the Jonestown cult. Yeah. I remember that,
ushers were passing poison. And people were taking the poison. This had nothing to do I don't know. I just don't understand how.
It was completely parallel to religion.
We're not talking about... Yes, I can understand you having so much power over me. You hypnotized one person, two people, three people, four people. That's fine. But 50, 100, 500, I'm like, what is going on here? You know, my people will say this is juju.
And I mean, this is a complexity that I think the novel does really well to capture, that sense that even though some forms of, you know, shall we say, belief are in some senses irrational, it doesn't make them less complex. You know, these are still very deeply human things for people to be kind of drawn into, you know, the obedience or the following of certain charismatic figures, you know, because they have, you know, all of these incredibly human vulnerabilities, you know. So even some of the deeply flawed figures who kind of make up the story in Gaslight are people who you can kind of go, okay, I understand how they would have been led down this path, so I understand how they would have gotten there. And that's, again, something that I think the novel does really well to kind of put into context.
I think that's why the guy is a psychologist, an investigative psychologist. I really want, when I talk about these stories and I have conversations like I'm having with you, I like it when the word understand comes up more. You know, I mean, of course, I would like those things like, oh, you know, you're really a very brilliant writer. I also like the one that says, this is so fantastic story or whatever. But honestly, deeply, truly, key words that get me excited and make me feel as if I have achieved my intention and I feel truly blessed that happened is when people say words like context. I understand it more. I get it more. You know, I never thought that Nigeria was like this. You know, I thought Nigeria was like that, but I didn't know this about it. It just, you know, it just makes me feel as if you're just enriching our ability to appreciate how similar we really are.
Mm.
It's not how complex that situation is. It's not how complex that country is, or that that's not really what I just like the fact that through understanding, I get yesterday. The next week is the launch of the Italian version of Gaslight. Journalist was asking me questions and was explaining Nigeria to me through the eyes of Gaslight. You know, and she was like, "Yeah, now I get it, because I could see places like that in Italy. I could see politicians like that in Italy." You know, and we're talking about the idea that maybe some of the waves of these things of patriarchy and all of that is the reason why, for the first time, Italy has a female prime minister. Mm. You know, and I was joking with her. I was like, "Well, I mean, Malawi is supposed to be the undeveloped country of Africa, but they've had a female president before you." You know what I mean? But we're having these conversations around the idea of not differences but similarities, and that can only happen on the basis of understanding. I hope that makes sense, and that excites me a lot. That excites me more than the almost like the creative value of the work, but the ability of the work to actually generate these conversations is helps me to no end.
Oh, fantastic. So I know we're running a bit out of time here, but one thing I want to focus on just briefly is, you know, when I read Gaslight, one of the things that really stayed with me, you know, and I kind of read it in this, you know, I sat down with it and I felt like I was transported away, because the pace kind of sweeps you along. And I'm curious about, you know, I had this feeling when reading it, you know, when I, you know, sometimes you read a book and you get the sense that, okay, you know, the person who wrote this book definitely knows a bit about screenplay. They know a little bit about, you know, filmmaking, because they know how to draw a scene in a particular way, a way that really kind of lifts off the page and kind of sweeps the action along. And so I was curious about the role that film plays in the kind of style of your work. You know, I know that you're an avid filmmaker as well, and I think you're a bit of a film buff too. So I'd be interested to know what your answer is to that question, because I definitely feel there's something of that influence kind of playing out in subtle ways, but in very particular ways in this film.
It's not subtle, though, to be honest. Yeah, it's very deliberate. You know, that's those deliberate choices that you make as a creative person. Sometimes you regret later, by the way. Let's just remember, you know, you have this nice, crazy idea and you think it's going to work. And then now the die is cast, you know. Mm. One of the devices that I used. So from day one, I wanted to write an immersive story.
Mm.
I wanted to write a story that the reader feels so immersed in, that they feel as if they're a camera in the room. You know, the camera in the room kind of thing. And to do that, I had to employ certain devices, like, for instance, writing in the present tense.
Mm.
So it's all in the present tense, you know, so you're there, you're in the moment, it's real time kind of thing. And I do have a film background, you're right. I mean, I trained as a screenwriter and done some work in the screen space, you know, been on set a number of times. And you understand. And yes, I am a film buff. Yes, and so you understand where to start a story, and you understand how to end the story. I would be writing in the middle of the night, and you know, my kids would come from behind, and they were like, "What are you doing?" Because apparently, before I type something, I would do my hand like this. I'll do my hand like this, and then I'll say, "Okay. Oh, is the left, okay, did he use the left hand or did you use the right hand?" You know, I look like a, what do you call it? Like, a, you know, those people, what do they, like a fighter, you know, or a mime artist, you know, kind of thing. But you literally have to almost like act it out so that you can visualize it on paper. And so, yeah, it's intentional. And if it works and it's successful, it's great. If it doesn't, ooh, you're finished. It's touch and go.
I can definitely say that it works. So I think my final question to you is sort of, I mean, I know you've kind of touched on where you see the novel or the character going. You know, I think, and reading the book, you definitely get a sense that, okay, there's much more to go in terms of this character. I get the feeling that you're not done with him, certainly. And we're not done with him as readers. We want to know more, you know.
Thank you.
And that's a very good thing. I suppose my question is one about where your settings will be, you know, because in the one sense, this is, as we said, a story that's set in Nigeria, but which has this distinctly kind of worldly flavor to it. You know, I think that it makes it readable in any kind of context. Do you see that kind of playing out for the rest of them, or do you see him and the family leaving Nigeria at some point? I mean, what can you tell us?
I think right now I'm doing everything to keep them in Nigeria. even if Philip wants to leave, I really am trying to do everything. There's still so many stories to tell, you know, that there's still so much to uncover and to discover. I mean, Africa has such a rich literary culture, but I'm not sure we don't have a rich crime fiction culture.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it would be a shame to lose that opportunity and take him to New York to compete with the Lincoln Lawyer series. You know what I mean? You know, so that's how I feel, you know. I'm very proud of my Africanness. I'm very proud of my Nigerianness. And it took a while to get to this space, you know, where I am so comfortable in my skin and in my Nigerianness and in my identity, that I think I'm now privileged enough to be able to see the good and the bad and to mix it all together and say, no, there's still stories to tell. So they're going to be around in Nigeria for a while, even if Philip is reluctant. And I will need some convincing to take them out of that space.
Okay. Thank you so much, Femi. This is a conversation I think I probably had 20 more questions, you know, and certainly more than last time since we had to record it. But thanks that you could do this again. It's been wonderful to chat to you, as always. You know, it always just expands the horizon of the book, you know, and I think it's an absolutely wonderful project that I hope people will go out and buy and read, because it really is a very, very gripping story and a very interesting one.
Thank you so much, Bramoyi, for having me. I'm so grateful. And I'm happy that you got me again and we got to talk, and I can't wait to talk to you again. This time with those 20 questions, and I'll be more succinct. It's just that right now I'm caffeinated and I'm so excited to be talking to you guys that the internet is actually working. Thank you.
Yeah, thankful for good internet for a change.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.